Do you think you're paying more for food these days? If those groceries, especially fresh food, seem more expensive, we now have some evidence to back up your concerns. A Climate Council report has warned that global warming is also contributing to rising food costs in Australia. The Council, which is an independent crowd-funded organisation, took a look at the effects of an increasingly variable and severe climate on both food production, food costs, and also its distribution. Anna Vito spoke with the Council's Leslie Hughes, Professor of Biology from Macquarie University, who says consumers are already seeing the impact of extreme weather in their local supermarkets, and that's likely to continue.
We know that in past droughts, food prices, especially for things like fruit and vegetables that are heavily reliant on irrigation water, do go up a lot. Similarly, when farmers destock during droughts, you can get an immediate lowering of price as a lot of meat comes onto the market. But then it can take several years after a drought for farmers to restock. So those shortages of meat products then can cause prices to go up. So the consumer feels the impacts of climate change through food prices.
The report itself makes the point that Australia's climate is considerably more variable than many other food-producing countries. So how directly can we link increasing food prices over time to climate change and not just variability?
Yes, look, we can't link, you know, the food price of a particular product on a particular day. We have to look at climate over a longer-term period. And when we do that, we see that Australia's average temperatures are going up, consistent with the rest of the world. We can see long-term patterns in changes of rainfall, such as declining spring rainfall in southern Australia. And in some cases, we can also see a statistical trend towards increases in either the frequency or the intensity of extreme events. So it depends on what you're looking at. But these days, the impacts of climate change are becoming ever more obvious. We are getting the sorts of climatic conditions that we haven't seen in the past. So while we still have a highly variable climate, we can think of that variability as also being on an upward trend.
We should be expecting these kinds of events more regularly at a more severe level. Is that what the report has found?
Well, yes, indeed. And that's what the climate models are telling us and have been telling us for quite some time. So while Australia has been a place of fantastic food security, you know, most of us take the supply of safe, affordable, high-quality food availability for granted. We can't afford to be complacent, especially economically, because agriculture still forms one of the pillars of the Australian economy.
How can Australia, and indeed can Australian agriculture, adapt to the changing climate? Are we capable of meeting that challenge?
Well, look, to a certain extent, yes. And indeed, many farmers are already adapting. You know, we have farmers that are using more heat-tolerant varieties of crops. They're using new breeds of livestock, such as cattle and sheep, that are more tolerant of high temperatures. They're starting to use cultivars of crops that need less water. All of those things are adaptation measures.
We are seeing, particularly in the area of drought tolerance, a conversation about the role of genetically modified crops. Is that something that Australia does need to be looking seriously at to meet this climate challenge? And I guess how do you see that happening when it's such a controversial and politically charged issue?
Yeah. Well, look, from a personal perspective, and I'm a biologist, so I'm speaking from a biologist's perspective, I think genetically modified organisms do have a place. I think it should be a case-by-case basis. Certainly there are some pretty amazing scientific breakthroughs in terms of producing cultivars that are more drought tolerant or more pest tolerant or whatever. It will be part of the adaptation process, I think. Of course, I understand that there's a lot of resistance to GMOs, and I totally respect that point of view. It'll be a case-by-case basis.
And that's Professor Leslie Hughes from the Climate Council of Australia speaking with Anna Vito. Now, it would be hard to imagine any passionate viticulturist inflicting drought on part of their vineyard, But over the last 14 years, that's exactly what's happened at Wynns in the Coonawarra wine region of South Australia. It's been trying to establish the effects of climate change, and its research will be presented at the Australian Cabernet Symposium this week. Wynns vineyard manager Alan Jenkins shared some insights.
We know that when we have cold temperatures in that flowering period, that our yields can be dramatically reduced in the subsequent seasons. And if we know that in advance, then we can change our pruning techniques to increase the yield by leaving more buds on the vine. Conversely, if we have really warm conditions and we know what the cutoff temperatures are now after many years, then we'll know which seasons are going to produce good crops because of very good flowering and set. This can help us predict whether we need to do bunch thinning to get the vegetative come fruitful capacity of the plant right.
So from a grape growing perspective, what can growers take from your research?
They'll be able to take away some benchmark that will help them be able to predict more accurately how they should prune the following year. It will help provide more foundation of knowledge around temperature influence upon yield and ultimately fruit quality.
So the research is a lengthy look at climate change. What are some of those take-home messages from your point of view, having been involved in this research for a very long time and analysing all of these results?
It's been really valuable to us in terms of being able to get a yield and vine vigour balance right in most seasons and to even out some of the severe biennial bearing that you sometimes have in viticulture, where you have really big crops one year and really low crops the next year.
So what are some of those techniques, apart from pruning, that helps you achieve that balance on the vine?
If, for example, you have a really warm flowering and you have a really good crop set, then typically many people would go in and bunch thin at veraison or the colour change time when the berries start to ripen, and reduce the amount of crop on the vine to give it a chance to ripen in a reasonable time frame before opening rains. And you don't want the vine to ripen over a really long, very slow period because there's not enough leaf to ripen it properly. So that there's a need to have that yield to leaf balance very closely aligned. So bunch thinning at veraison is one technique.
It sounds as though the research has really informed what you do here at the winery.
It has, and we've also been doing quite a lot of work that we'll be sharing in the symposium around some of our water management. Another impact of climate change can be extended periods of drought. We know that the underground water resource in Coonawarra and most of the limestone coast is underpinned by very strong, good average winter rainfalls that enables the water table to recharge. And we've been monitoring this closely over a long period of time. And by using alternative rootstocks and doing some trials around stressing some vines more than we would normally, we've learnt quite a lot about putting together some new strategies if we end up with less water into the future. Some of the results of some of those trials, wherein we've applied only 10%, for example, of the normal irrigation that we would to a Cabernet vineyard over a three-year period, and we'll be able to share the impact on fruit and wine and ultimately on the vine in the longer term.
You forced a drought on some of your vineyard.
Yeah, on a small block of Cabernet we did that. And we did that to see what the impact would be if we had no irrigation, or very little minuscule irrigation. And the vine coped with it fairly well for 2 years. But after 3 years, it was that small vineyard was struggling too much. And we're now looking at how we can bring it back and recover it. As a drought strategy, we would ideally not want to stress the vineyard more than 1 or 2 years. But if you've got limited water, you may decide, for example, to stress parts of your vineyard estate, but not all of it.
And that's Alan Jenkins, the vineyard manager from Wynns in the Coonawarra wine region, speaking with Cassandra Steith. A change of pace now. Have you ever been tested for drug driving? It is becoming more common alongside the familiar drink driving breath test. But the number of people caught drug driving is also on the rise, especially in regional Australia. In some country towns, one in five drivers tested has drugs in their system. It's why police have stepped up efforts to screen for drug driving. But the tests themselves cost hundreds of dollars, and one federal MP is worried that that cost is preventing police from doing their job. Here's our regional affairs reporter, Lucy Barber.
Lynette Satellich will never forget her drive home from an all-night dance party 14 years ago. She'd taken ecstasy and marijuana.
I had a cigarette, put the music up as loud as I could, and basically at the moment when I thought, I don't think I can do this, it was already too late.
Lynette fell asleep at the wheel and crashed. She and her passenger were okay, but others weren't.
This man came from sort of behind us and he said, I don't know if you realise, but there's a man in the bushes and he doesn't have a pulse. I just screamed, I think. I just fell into a heap of shaking, shuddering, it was the worst, absolute worst moment of my life ever to know that someone's death was my fault because I'd made a mistake of getting into a car after I'd had drugs.
Sadly, stories like this have become all too common. In Victoria, 22% of drivers killed have illicit drugs in their systems. The problem is even worse in regional areas. In the New South Wales town of Griffith, one in five drivers tested is positive. And police say in some regional towns, the number could be as high as one in three.
It's probably more intense because of the nature of the distances that people have to travel.
Inspector Martin Borman from Victoria Police says his force has more than doubled drug tests in the last year, but at a significant cost.
At the roadside, if a person is screened and they're negative, it costs between $35 and $40. If a person is screened at the roadside and drugs are found to be present, it'll be costing us up to about $600.
That's compared to a random breath test, which costs about a dollar. It's expensive because the technology is still being developed.
Over time, it will improve and allow us to do things in a more efficient way. But it is difficult when these types of enforcement programs cost a lot of money.
Speed, alcohol and fatigue are still the biggest killers on Australian roads. But one federal MP is worried that lives are being lost because the cost of drug testing is so high.
It becomes an inhibitor to our police doing their job.
Nationals MP Darren Chester is co-chair of the Parliamentary Friends of Road Safety Group. He says drug driving and road safety is a major problem in his regional electorate of Gippsland, especially amongst young men.
They feel like they're bulletproof and they also feel like they're not going to get caught.
Currently, state governments fund drug testing. But Mr. Chester believes it's time the federal government pitched in.
When you have a road toll which is in excess of 1,000 people dying every year in Australian roads, just think about that. That's 25 people per week dying on Australian roads. This is a public health issue that demands attention. It demands a national response as well as the obvious state response. So I think there's an opportunity here for the federal government to work even more strongly, if you like, in the future with our state governments to provide a more consistent approach, a more coordinated approach right across the nation to start tackling this as the major public health crisis that it is.
So you want the federal government to provide funding for the state specifically for drug testing?
What I'd like to see is the federal government adopting a more holistic approach to the whole issue of road trauma. Now, whether it be through increased funding to assist with the illicit testing of drugs, which is primarily a state responsibility at the moment, but under the National ICE strategy, we're looking at a whole range of measures to try and control this menace in our community. So it may well be that we can come out with a recommendation from the National ICE strategy for extra resources to assist in that regard. Now, my fear is that perhaps over the last 10 or 20 years, where we've made some massive inroads in our road toll, we've come to accept perhaps a level of complacency, or perhaps there's a level that we seem to accept that road trauma is inevitable. It's just a reflection of the fact that our road toll, which was trending downwards quite strongly, now seems to have been have bottomed out, if you like.
Lynette Satellich supports the call for the federal government to do more.
If it costs $600 for every positive test, that's absolutely ridiculous.
She hopes speaking out about her experience will prevent others from making the same mistake.
Honestly, just don't do it. It's not worth someone's life.
Lynette Satellich, ending Lucy Barber's report. And that's our program for this week. A big thanks to Angela Grant for technical production. I'm Edwina Farley. Hope you can stay with us on RN.